Season 2, Episode 15.
Good storytelling changes pace. It has big moments and small moments and loud and quiet.
You're listening to UX Podcast, coming to you from Stockholm, Sweden.
Helping the UX community explore ideas and share knowledge for over a decade.
We are your hosts, James Royal Lawson.
And Pat Axbom.
With listeners in countries and territories all over the world, from Serbia to Luxembourg.
Today we are talking to none other than graphic designer Ellen Lupton, known for her love of typography, and the author of Thinking with Type, which is now in its third edition, as well as Extra Bold, Design is Storytelling, Graphic Design Thinking, and lots more books.
As well as being quite a prolific writer, Ellen is also a creator, educator, and designer, and teaches at the Maryland Institute College of Art, where she is the design chair.
And we talked to Ellen, obviously, about storytelling, about visual design, and we receive some really, really practical advice.
Today's interview was recorded at From Business to Buttons, which is a conference that is held every May here in Stockholm, Sweden.
For this year's event on May 24th, use the code UXPODCAST for a 10% discount. Heavily discounted student tickets are also available.
Well, then, in your presentation, Storytelling and Visual Design, you've got a number of points that you share. One of them in particular is Rule of Threes. So I thought we'd take two topics. One of which is the Rule of Threes. Tell us a little bit about what the Rule of Three means.
So the Rule of Threes is used by writers and comedians and designers to help people cognitively make choices about information or understand a process. So if you think about fairy tales, there's often three wishes or three dancing princesses or three doors and the last one you should never open. And so that number three has a kind of archetypal significance to people. If we consider the fundamental pace of a story, it has a beginning, a middle, an end. A really simple process has three steps: one, two, three. In fact, it might feel incomplete if it only had two. So we want that sense of resolution that the third step brings it to conclusion. So using the Rule of Threes is really useful for designers to simplify a very long process, to like visually group many steps into three chunks or many features of a product into three buckets, to take a long series of things and find three phases, or even in a complex layout, like in a dashboard, where you might have multiple choices of views of the data, to say, well, here's three, and kind of hide the other ones, is just very useful, and it helps people with their cognition of complex information.
And when you explained it like that, it was like, blew my mind, kind of how often it appears, and I don't really think about it. It's just common sense, it feels like. It's not that I learned it as a designer. It's just it's a pattern that just makes sense as a human being.
It's beginning, middle, and end. It's common sense that is reiterated time and again.
Yeah.
And then it becomes familiar. But it has an arc. And stories have an arc. Aristotle defined a story as a whole action of a certain magnitude. So it has to be whole. Something happens and then comes to a resolution, and it has to matter. Yeah. It has to be worthwhile in some way. And that one, two, three creates that sense of an arc and something that has been completed.
I think back about how, I mean, I suppose we've had quite a few magic numbers, you know, over the years with design. I remember back when we were talking about menus and things, we say, well, you know, you don't want any more than 7 items, or this, like, 4 maybe comes into it. We do get a few of these numbers thrown about. So, you know, other situations when we should avoid forcing ourselves to 3.
Well, sometimes you need 7.
Yeah.
Right. And 7 also comes from fairy tales.
Yes.
It is a beautiful number. It's a prime number. It has an elegance within the sequence from 1 to 10 that's very attractive. And of course, people can remember 7 things, not me anymore. But and phone numbers were broken down into units of 3 and 4 to make that number 7 more palatable.
Right.
So the chunking, yeah.
Yeah.
And you had an example on stage, I think it was from Starbucks, where they had 1, 2, 3 steps, but the second step was made of 2 parts. And that was really interesting because you also got the question at the end around, well, is that ethical to do it like that? And thinking about it, it did make sense. Had it been 4 steps, it wouldn't have been as easy to actually take it to heart.
Exactly. Yeah. The 3 is very comprehensible. And in that Starbucks ad, if I can help people visualize it, the 3 steps were named, but they were also represented visually with a big icon. Mm-hmm. And that really helps people, reinforces visually this series of 3 things.
Yeah, so I can imagine lots of listeners now trying to, you know, looking at like their wizards and that they have and things and trying to, how can we cram this down into 3 instead?
We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
So another one of the, I joked a bit that we have like a rule of 3 and we'll use 2, but we'll see how that goes. Labyrinths and mazes. Now, in your presentation, maybe you did this more because we're in Sweden, but you had a wonderful little segment when talking about the maze of IKEA. I'm going to say maze of IKEA, which wasn't really.
Well, so an IKEA store is a highly designed experience, as are many retail spaces, but I think IKEA to a very high and self-conscious degree. And I was interested in this when I was working on my book, Design is Storytelling. And I remember just how controlled the experience of IKEA is. And so I started looking up research to find out, you know, evidence about why the stores are designed the way they are. And one paper that I read explained that technically IKEA is not a maze at all. It is a labyrinth. And that these are 2 different paradigms for turning a bunch of space into a path, right? Which is what a store design is. Mm. And technically, a maze is a puzzle. And it's designed to get you lost and to give you, the user, constant choices, exhausting choices. Do I go left? Do I go right? Do I go forward? Do I go back? A labyrinth is a fixed path. Mm. And these were created in churches, in gardens, and even in like a little kind of fidget device where you could trace the labyrinth with your hand. Mm. And it's meant to be meditative.
Yeah.
You take a walk and you're not constantly asking yourself which way to go next.
Yeah, so it's rubbing a mental stimuli and forcing you to think, forcing you to back up on yourself and to try again. You're actually, now I'm turning off. Now I'm just going straight without going straight.
Exactly. You're not constantly asking yourself, where do I go next?
Mm-hmm.
In an IKEA store, so I went back to IKEA with my camera, which I always have, my phone. And I wanted to be like super conscious of how the store reinforces that path. And I noticed that the path is actually a different floor surface. Mm. It has a curb on either side to, you know, help people not trip over the 2 surfaces. There's actually arrows that are projected through a light on the ceiling so that arrow doesn't get worn off from people walking on it. It is like made of light. I was just amazed to see the degree to which the path is truly reinforced and underscored by the design.
And you compared it to the Yellow Brick Road from The Wizard of Oz, which I thought was amazing, because when you made that reference, it made sense.
Yes, in The Wizard of Oz, the path is the story.
Yeah.
They go to, you know, they are following that path, and the path gets broken, and it's interrupted, and there's bad things that happen, but they need to keep finding the path.
Exactly.
So, something I always used to like with IKEA stores was the secret doors. And years, I to be honest, I think previously the secret doors were harder to find, because like you know when you're halfway through a lap, and you kind of know, I just need to go to the warehouse, I need to go to checkout. So then there'll be a section of wall which actually is a door, and you can cut through to the warehouse.
Yeah.
And this used to be kind of like, you know, oh, secret. Whereas now though they seem to be a little bit more. They're actually signed now. And often they're actually open. Whereas before, they never used to be signed.
And you were sort of a power user when you knew where the doors were.
Yeah, yeah. So they've made some kind of adaptation.
Shortcuts.
Yeah, they've made shortcuts more official now than when before they were kind of like secret power. Which I don't know. I mean, storytelling-wise, I kind of like them as a secret power.
Devious and like I'm a consumer with true agency when I go through the secret passageway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But actually it's there for a purpose.
Yeah.
Otherwise they wouldn't include it.
It is, presumably. But it still feels like gamification that I can cut off the path. I can go through the game faster.
But then you'll miss kitchens.
I will miss kitchens.
No one can do that.
Presumably they have an evidence that said that, you know, the level of irritation and annoyance that customers who were forced to do the full lap who did know where they need to be was too great, so they started to...
It's an escape valve.
Yeah.
A pressure valve.
Yeah, which was good.
I have to make one note on language, since we have so many listeners in Sweden. We don't have a separate word for maze. We just have the word labyrinth, meaning probably the both things. I even tested it in Google Translate. What's the difference between a maze and a labyrinth? Swedish, what's the difference between a labyrinth and a labyrinth, it says.
Well, in English, we use them indiscriminately anyway. Or in other languages.
So,
it's really like a technical thing. Yeah. And like I have a book called Mazes and Labyrinths because people do use them without distinguishing, and it's not an error to use the two words. However, there are two different principles of design, and that is clear. And you wouldn't put a maze on the floor of a church for the monks to walk around because they would lose their minds, you know? So it's two different paradigms. We do have two beautiful words in English and some other languages, but everybody can grasp the conceptual difference between a fixed path and a path with lots of choice.
So how do I know if I'm in a maze or a labyrinth design situation? You know, is it easy for me to kind of recognize that, okay, now I'm doing a website that's a maze, or now I'm doing a website that's a labyrinth?
Well, likely a website would have some of both, you know, little departments of difference. So think about a process that you want to have be a 1-2-3 sequence, and you want to maintain people's interest and comprehension across that sequence. That's probably a good labyrinth. If people are customizing a service or choosing different features to combine in their account, or reading a newspaper where you have constant side stories and different avenues to travel on, that's a labyrinth.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that makes so much sense. And it made me frustrated when I was trying to translate that to Swedish, and I realized, I can't. But I understand the concept. Now I need to think about explaining it in different ways.
We could think of linear and non-linear.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And a website or a digital product is going to have some linear components and some non-linear ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
And thinking about psychologically the difference, the sense of freedom created by a non-linear experience, but also the potential for exhaustion. That people will become fatigued.
Yeah. Yes. And the way you described this on stage was so vivid and fun, so I'm going to stick with IKEA, because you talked about descending into the belly of the warehouse which was just amazing. And then approaching, well, the final boss in a game, the checkouts, which is so true. And everybody understands what you mean. And sometimes it's important to also have the friction or some things that are more difficult than others. You touched upon that a bit towards the end, I think.
Well, if you think about a good story changes energy. Like an action film, if it's all car chases and there's never any dialogue, then no woman will ever go to that movie. Right? We cannot have that constant intensity. So a good storytelling changes pace. It has big moments and small moments and loud and quiet. And a good experience design should have changes in pace. You know, you come into the IKEA store and you're full of optimism. You're going to redo your whole house. And you leave a bit depleted, you know, with more stuff than you wanted and maybe not solving as many problems. So at IKEA, they build in rewards and rests, right? You're not always being assaulted. And so when I go to the IKEA store and I make it through the checkout, which is the final challenge of my hero's journey, there's a whole other restaurant on the other side of checkout which sells hot dogs. And these hot dogs are wonderful and welcome and super cheap. And it's like, I need this snack. Right, you may have already had a full lunch with your family in the big cafeteria, and that's wonderful too. But this is like an emergency hot dog. Yeah. This is mercy.
And it aligns with peak end theory, which means that you leave the store actually feeling energized.
And you know what? Mm. Last time I got to the hot dogs and was wanting the hot dog. We've been here for a while now. I've done all this. I've punished myself with the journey through. I need the hot dog. Mm. They'd introduced one of those self-service touchscreen ordering units to get the hot dog. So, of course, me being me, I was now confronted by a new interface design, which I was having to fight with, learn, analyze, kind of fight through. So I looped through a second hero's journey when I was just ready for, give me the goddamn sausage.
Such a good point.
But, you know, occupational hazard coming against new interfaces at the end of a journey there. Given that we've talked about the importance of three, so I can't stick to two. We're going to have a third one. In your presentation, you talk a lot about the use of colour as well, in relation to signifying, I suppose, a change of world, going from the ordinary world to something else, and how we use that on websites. Explain a little bit more about the use of colour.
So as designers, we are creating a world for our users, and we are inviting them to cross the threshold into that world. And once they enter, everything should go together. So think about Dorothy finally makes it to the city of Oz, and everything is green. Mm. And this is magical. This is not how things normally look. Mm. And so she knows where she is. When we use color as designers, there are many functions, you know, including warnings and codified uses of color. But color is also used to create an atmosphere. So many fintech companies, for example, are predominantly green, and you are entering this green money world. Mm. An app about, you know, renting camping spaces might use predominantly soft browns and pale blues to create an illusion of nature, even though you're still just looking at your phone, right, which has no nature in it. But those colors help to create a world. It's one of the simplest tools that we have for changing where you were into something new, which is what storytelling does, creates a world.
And those perceptions, I mean, are they global? Are they universal human perceptions of, like, you know, the nature, the soft tones, the browns and greens of nature, or is that something that's coming from our biases as the countries that we come from?
Well, with color, I think there's always some of both. There's always some cultural bias. The color red has different meanings in different cultures. The color white could signify death in one culture, but we use black in another culture. However, there are also some universals, like I think nature has some pretty beautiful colors that we can borrow and look at, but you might make them softer or more intense. You know, there's so much choice that goes in designing those combinations.
Hmm. And the color itself will tell a story, which I think is interesting, because one of my key takeaways was sort of from the beginning when you were talking about how icons told a story. So even by what color the icons are, or what they're signifying, or what action there is, the full story is within the icon. And I think this is interesting for designers in that it doesn't have to be the whole journey or the whole flow that is the story. Every element can have its own story.
If you think about a movie is made up of scenes, and each scene has a goal. Someone in the scene is trying to get something, and they either get it or they don't. And that's what the scene is for. If they don't get it, then they have another scene where they try again. If you think about experience design, it's many actions. Even something like subscribing to a service includes many actions that need a beginning, a middle, an end, a sense of completion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Anyone who's ever filled in a form knows that that's a story.
Right. Made up of many actions. So something like an icon is a signal for one action within a much bigger journey.
Mind-blowing.
All these different elements that we can use to help convey a story in the designs that we have.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm so much more aware of it now, because I know I've used a lot of these things that you've been talking about, but now I'm so much more aware of why.
And how they're incorporated. These are patterns that are universal, but we can become more conscious of them. And I discovered it by reading lots of books about how to write a story. Yeah. And doing that, I was like, wow, this reminds me of action in design, and these patterns are so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you, Per. Thank you, James. So much fun to talk to you.
So now we are actually moving into part three of the podcast episode. And I hadn't reflected on that so much before. We actually always do have three parts to each UX podcast episode. We have the intro, we have the interview, and we have this part where you and I reflect on what we've talked about in the interview.
Yeah, and that's despite the fact that you do have three audio files that you need to play with to produce the... Yeah. But interestingly, in just this episode, not only do we have the usual intro body of the podcast and the outro, the interview itself had three parts.
Right, exactly. It's turtles all the way down. And three of us.
And three of us too. I think... Reflecting back on the on our chat with Ellen, in some ways, none of it was new. I mean, yes, there was some new aspects, and both of us said during the interview that we were, oh yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that before. So we got a new perspective on some things that I think that you know we have been aware of over the years. But that itself made me think about just the quantity of concepts, of principles, routines and so on, everything that we who are working in the digital space as designers, what we need to have in our bag, our toolbox, and that we need to be able to pull out of our heads on demand in many situations and get it all right.
Right, and it's so good to reflect on these things, because what I realized was I kept saying, well, I know this, but I forgot why I was doing it.
Yes. Yeah. So even when you remember to pull that tool out of your toolbox, you've maybe forgotten the essence of why it's there, or the underlying principle that you know backs up the theory or the whole why are you doing it. Me and you have been in this game now for a long time.
A couple of years.
We're learning new stuff. We're relearning old stuff.
Exactly, yes.
And I think, that's I think it's reassuring to know that it's okay to not remember everything all the time.
Yes. And I love it when we get into these episodes, because both you and I actually do love the details of designing as well as the overarching strategy. But talking to Ellen in this interview, I realized, well, even the icon is a strategy. So you have to remember that you are making considered decisions about everything that's going on within every step of the way. So you're just making sure that you are doing it in a deliberate way.
Yeah, considered design and considering every aspect of what you're designing, and also remembering what to consider.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's a bit full circle there.
It's funny because you and I, I'm not going to mention what company it was, but you and I went into a website together earlier today, and we noticed that a company had like four options. And we said, well, that doesn't make sense. It should have been three. And we looked at it and we realized, well, it would have been much better if it had been three.
Yeah, because the fourth option was actually of a different flavor, you could say, to the other three. So it actually didn't fit into the story or the packaging of the first three options. So, yeah, okay, we had primed ourselves by refreshing our knowledge about the power of three, the storytelling arc, and so on. So we were looking for that kind of, you know, I was ready to find fours and fives or whatever and try and boil them down to three. But yeah, there's so much out there. And I wonder as well about design systems, or even, you know, when we're getting designs served or generated for us from other tools, that puts another demand on our ability to consider design. And you mentioned icons. I mean, if I've got an icon set or an icon from my design system, does that enhance my ability to apply it in a considered way, or does it limit it?
Right. And am I applying it in a way that is intended to make it more visually appealing, or actually also because it tells a story, it complements what I'm trying to accomplish with my design? And you tend to forget that level of detail that goes into thinking about what story am I telling, even as you have three pricing options. What story are you telling by having these selected pricing options? There's always a story there. And that's really helping me think about this. And I'm definitely going to be applying this idea of, well, I had four steps, but I'm going to try and make it into three. One of the steps may have two things, but it makes more sense. It's just easier to cope with it. It tells a better story.
Mm. Yeah. I know in the time that's passed since we talked to Ellen, I have actually done that. I've looked back on some of the suggestions and design work I already had kind of like in the pipeline, and we pivoted and we actually made a couple of fours into threes, which is actually
was nice,
and it actually did work better.
It seems almost silly. It's too simple. It's a great rule because you almost don't believe it. But when you apply it, you realize, well, of course it has to be this way.
But there's also, I suppose, there's also a hazard or danger in the simplicity, because what becomes a risk there is, looping back to what you said earlier in this outro, it becomes a bit of a default. It becomes, I need three options. And you lose sight of the story arc, the power of three, the reasoning why it is.
And Ellen did say, sometimes you need seven.
She did when I prompted her about that. Sometimes you do need seven. But it's be conscious of what you're doing and consider your design. Yeah. It's wonderful. Recommended listening, Pat.
Some more storytelling lined up for us, I guess.
Of course. Yep. I mean, we have dabbled a few times now with storytelling over the years. And just this time, I think it absolutely is our interview with Anna Dahlström.
Oh, yeah.
About storytelling. And the reason why I think absolutely is because in that podcast, we do talk about three-act stories. So it should dovetail really nicely into this conversation.
Makes complete sense.
Yeah, to dive a little bit deeper into the aspects of storytelling.
Episode 239.
Yes, of season one, as we refer to it these days.
The longest ever season. If you want us to be part of your next conference, event, or in-house training, we are offering workshops, talks, and courses to inspire and help you grow as individuals, teams, and organizations. Get in touch by emailing hey@uxpodcast.com.
I'd like carrier pigeons as well, Per. If people can send us messages via carrier pigeon, I'd accept that.
I would accept that, definitely.
Yeah, send your pigeons to us.
And a message in a bottle. Remember to keep moving.
See you on the other side.
James, do you know why Norwegians build their own tables?
No, but I have no idea why Norwegians build their own tables.
No IKEA.